so. And, you know, I don't know if God thinks so either. I'm Dr. Ray.
This is Full-Time Catholic Radio for Southeast Michigan, 990 WDEO, Ypsilanti, Detroit, or on the Internet at WDEO.net.
This is D.L. Hudson. Welcome to Church and Culture. This show is devoted to exploring the interaction between our faith and our culture. Each week, I will talk with expert guests on topics ranging from literature, art, and music to politics, liturgy, spirituality, and education. Thank you for joining us. Our guest today on Church and Culture is Father Edward Perrone. He was ordained in the Archdiocese of Detroit in 1978, and he served at the Assumption Grotto Church since 1994 and has an extraordinary musical background and music program, and that's why I've asked him to join us today. Father, welcome to Church and Culture.
Thanks, Dale.
You know, when I look at all you've accomplished, and of course, we've known each other for a while, and I've followed your work and your various recordings. Is it true to say that your parish, Assumption Grotto, has one of the more unusual music liturgies in the United States?
I would say certainly it is unusual, unfortunately unusual, because I think we have a wide repertory of sacred music that we perform here.
And you've actually formed a choir in 1994 and evidently have some kind of access to an orchestra because you've made several recordings with them. And we're going to talk about your mentor, Paul Perret, here in a second, who was a longtime conductor in Detroit, very famous. But you've also done quite a few performances in the church using your orchestra and chorus, including a mass you wrote in 2011 that has just a wonderful name. It was called Fountain of Beauty, is that correct?
Right, Fountain of Beauty, yes.
Yeah. How often do you get the full orchestra and chorus going at Assumption Grotto?
I would say we have them around 6 to 8 times a year.
Oh, that's wonderful. Well, here's what, you know, the reason why we're talking, and you know this because we've talked about it before, and I'm talking with Father Edward Perrone from Assumption Grotto Church in Detroit, is why is music in Catholic liturgy nationwide pretty much, how shall I put it, not up to grade?
Well, Dale, you're really touching on, of course, a very important subject for all Catholic people, but also, I would say, for people generally in our time, because the Church affects so much of our society. There's certainly a drabness, banality, secularity, in our liturgical expressions these last, 40-some years.
Yeah, even kitsch.
Right. That's right. And it's a serious problem. We've tried to address that problem not only in the music, but in the whole liturgical experience here, having Mass in the eastward direction ad orientem, reincorporating the Gregorian chant. We have a beautiful church. We are fortunate in that. And we try to perform the liturgy in a reverent way that's an inspiration to the people. And, of course, the sacred music, and in particular in this parish, the orchestral music, is a real enhancement to our prayer and our worship of God. And so I think it should be an inspiration to others who come here for their prayer, as well as for maybe replicating what we do here, at least even in a simple way, of restoring and reconnecting to our liturgical path.
I'm talking to Father Edward Perrone from Assumption Grotto Church in Detroit. Father, let me tell you a quick story, and you respond to it. Some years ago, my wife and I and my daughter, my son wasn't with us yet, lived outside New York City, and we were attending a parish there, and we started looking around at parishes for a liturgy with any kind of vitality. My wife had to grab me by the seat of my pants to keep me from walking into the middle of the church one day on Easter, because when they started singing Jesus Christ is Risen Today, nobody sang. I was the only one singing in the whole church. And I was at that time in my life when I did things like that. But we started going to St. Ignatius Church on Park Avenue, which, of course, as you know, has a wonderful choir and organist. I think Kent Tridle, I think he's still there. And as I went there week to week, I realized I was praying more. I realized I was worshiping more. I realized that the music, I hate to say it, made it easier.
Sure.
And why don't people get that?
Why don't people get it? Well, I think there has been an attempt to bring liturgy, replace liturgy by some kind of different experience, and where liturgy should be an approach to God, it should be our entry into a mystery of the divine presence. It's become a more of a social activity, something where we are gathered together for good feeling and experience of an interpersonal kind. But liturgy is a very particular kind of expression. It's an iconic thing. We are made aware of the presence of God through gesture, through music, through vestments, and even through the building of the church. And all of these things bring us into contact with the divine. And I think that's the thing that's missing in our liturgies. I think it's the thing that's probably drew you into the church.
Oh, absolutely. If you read my book, you know that.
Right.
Let me press you a little harder on this.
Sure.
By the way, those that are listening, this is Church and Culture, and I'm D.L. Hudson. I'm talking to Father Edward Perrone about music and liturgy in our Catholic Church. I am a convert, as you know. In fact, 30 years ago this month, I came into the church. And as you know, because we've talked about it, one of the primary reasons was its great tradition of art, philosophy, theology, literature. I mean, in other words, its expression. And I find, once I became a Catholic and came into the church 30 years ago, that I very rarely encounter the very things about Catholicism that drew me in the first place. Now, that's a big disappointment. Now, if I came to your church, I know that I would be delighted and spiritually recharged by what I found there, but I travel quite a bit among Catholics in the United States, and I would say there's only a handful of churches that are doing what you're doing. Is that correct?
I'm afraid that's perhaps the case. And the pity of it is that this is our inheritance as Catholics. These things shouldn't be denied us, they're just too rare, I'm afraid.
Well, you, of course, are unique in that you have extensive musical training, both as a pianist, organ, music theory. You even studied conducting with the great Jorge Mester of the Louisville Orchestra, a great pioneer in the performance of American music, and very distinguished pianist. You studied with Lee Luvisi as well. But you also formed a relationship with Paul Paré. Tell us about that.
Well, Paul Paré, of course, was the conductor of the Detroit Orchestra from the mid-50s to the mid-60s, and he made some wonderful recordings with the orchestra, so his legacy continues on through those.
Well, more than that, I mean, his recordings on Mercury are now considered some of the finest performances and finest recordings ever made.
Yes, that's true. That's true.
In fact, I noticed he made his own recording of his Mass.
He did.
St. Joan of Arc Mass.
He did, and it's wonderful. It's it can't be topped in many ways.
Well, tell us about you and Paul Paré, though.
Well, Paré, I saw him as when I was a young man, when going to his concerts, even a boy. My first orchestral concert was Paul Perret conducting the Detroit Orchestra. And it was, by the way, one of his compositions on that program, which was a rarity in those days. I was amazed by to see Paul Perret conduct was truly something. Such a spirited man.
What year would this have been, Paul?
This would have been around 62.
What was his last year with the Detroit Symphony?
Well, he came back every year as conductor emeritus, so he left here, I believe it was in that year. I may have seen him in 61, and he left as permanent conductor, I believe it was in 62.
What made you want to go out and do recordings of the music of Paul Perret? And basically, though, his composing career was over in the mid-30s, wasn't it?
It was, in 1940, actually.
And so we really know him only as a conductor after he came to the United States and took over the Detroit Symphony, but prior to that, he was a very active composer.
In his youth, he was known as a composer, and he only took up conducting quite by accident and found that he was quite good at it. The musicians responded well to him. I performed the Perret Mass here in 99.
Now tell our listeners just a little bit about that Mass, the name of it, when it was composed, and so forth.
The full title of the Mass is Mass for the 500th anniversary of the death of Joan of Arc, which was in 1931 and was a splendid celebration all over France, and particularly in Rouen, where Perret had grown up, by the way, in the music school there, the boy choir school. And so I don't know what occasioned the writing of the Mass, whether he was commissioned or it was his own idea. But he wrote a wonderful orchestral Mass. It was performed in the cathedral at Rouen with all the dignitaries attending. And I have a program surviving from all those years of the festivities. Perret was only one of several works performed at that time. And it's a unique orchestral work to have the richness of the Debussy orchestra along with that deep tradition of sacred music, polyphonic music that Perret grew up with, and have them presented together for the first time, I believe, is a historic piece.
Is this before or after Honegger's oratorio, Joan of Arc?
This would be, I believe, I'm not sure.
Well, you know, let me just tell our listeners, the Paul Perret Mass, the St. Joan of Arc Mass, is absolutely gorgeous. You've got to hear it. Those of you who love the Fauré Requiem, the Dirofle Requiem, if you love any kind of romantic sacred music in the French style, you must hear a recording. And speaking of that, Father, we have the Benedictus section that you recorded. And we're going to play a little bit of it and like for you to talk about it afterward. So here comes the Benedictus by Paul Perret of his Mass dedicated to St. Joan of Arc. That is gorgeous. This is D.L. Hudson. I'm talking to Father Edward Barone, who recorded that small section of the Benedictus from Paul Perret's Mass on the 500th anniversary of St. Joan of Arc. Father, you know, I hear all kinds of voices of other composers, but at the end of the day, it's a very unique and individual voice.
It is, isn't it? Especially for liturgical music. And it was intended for the liturgy. You have these wonderfully long lines of melody, and then you have underneath these harmonies that are taken from late Romanticism, Wagnerian almost.
Yeah.
And yet the whole thing is very French, and it's very suited to the...
It has a lightness.
There's a lightness to
yeah.
it. Yeah, that's true.
You know, the reason neither of us could answer my question about the oratorio Joan of Arc by Arthur Honegger is because it was a little bit later. It was in 1938, so looks like Perret beat him to the punch.
He did. And by the way, he also beat Duraflé to the punch. Sometimes it's said that Duraflé was the one who brought in the French orchestral palette of Debussy into the church. And it wasn't so. In fact, Perret conducted the first performance of Duraflé's Requiem, but that was much later.
It was 1947.
Right. So Perret was really the first to combine those things.
What was the Fauré Requiem, which has that such beautiful Agnus Dei that so many people know? Was the original version of that with a full orchestra, or was it with with organ?
It was with a smaller ensemble.
Mm-hmm.
And later he orchestrated it, and Fauré was not particularly known for his orchestration, and so we will not do that larger version here because most of the instruments are idle for...
I love this. I love this conversation. I mean, how many Catholic radio shows are going to be talking about which orchestration to use on the Fauré Requiem? I think we've completely made a first. That Benedictus, so let's go back. I mean, the way the male and female voices weave, there's almost operatic, but it's very, very devout.
It is. I mean, in if it were in an opera, one would say this is the love duet, the tenor and
the Liebestode.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
And it is a testament of love. This is the Benedictus of the Mass. The Eucharist has just been consecrated, and our Lord is present on the altar, and this is an expression of love.
The entire Mass, when you performed it, what year did you perform it at Assumption Grotto Church?
We performed it in 1998 for the first time.
And you went on to record it about that time, correct?
And we only made a recording from the live performance. We didn't make a studio recording.
I think live performances are often better because they have, you know, the vitality and the surprise.
That's true.
What kind of reaction did you get from your parishioners, from the audience that was there?
Well, the first time we performed it was Easter that year, and the former pastor, the one that I succeeded here, was giving the homily, and he completely discarded his notes after hearing the Gloria of the Mass, which he hadn't heard in rehearsal, and just said, that was the resurrection.
Oh, that's my homily.
That's what was the homily.
I love that. And, you know, it's wonderful to hear that story because it illustrates what we were talking about earlier, that music is not just an addition, a supplement, accidental, as we would say in metaphysics. It's part of the substance of our Mass, celebration of our Mass, is it not?
It certainly is, and it's an expression of the divine, and that's, I think, the thing, as I mentioned before, that's missing, this iconic sense of being in the presence of God and having that presence channeled into our worship.
Now, I must admit, Father, I'm going to make a public confession.
Sure.
I cannot count the times that I have been asked to sing a Gloria, and I thought to myself, this is not glorifying God in the least. And that's why nobody is singing, because it's a bad tune. Are there any contemporary Mass settings to be used liturgically in parishes around the country that really do justice to it?
Well, you know, there are several Catholic composers today, and our friend Stephen Huff has composed a mass, by the way.
Right, I know. I don't think it's been recorded yet, though.
No, I'm waiting for it.
Yeah.
But there are Catholic composers. I don't know if they've written a great deal of music for the liturgy. For example, Menotti wrote a mass.
Yeah.
We have a number of Catholic composers. Paul Creston, mm-hmm. although he's not living. Della Gioia has written
mm-hmm.
masses.
Mm-hmm. But none of these have made it into parish life.
No.
And frankly, I rarely hear any music for the liturgy that is composed, you know, in the 20th century or 21st, that is, to my ear anyway, worthy of it. Am I just a snob?
I don't think so. I think part of the problem has been an entire orientation of the liturgy towards congregational participation and popular culture to try to bring the people into the worship. And I think that's been an unfortunate emphasis because the worst of that pop culture has come into the church.
You know, but a good, memorable melody that you look forward to singing over and over.
Sure.
Is not something that is elitist. I mean,
no.
It's not at all. What we have in effect are dull melodies, uninspiring. Very few people sing with any gusto. I know that when I first came into the church in 84, at that time in Atlanta, they were singing an Agnus Dei at the very end of each mass, which almost brought me to tears. And I cannot sing it. I do not have memory of it. You probably do. But I loved it. It was just gorgeous. And then at some point in the next few years, it just disappeared. I never heard it again.
Yeah. Of course, it raises a number of questions. What happened to Latin? What happened to Gregorian chant? There are so many beautiful melodies, very singable, within the range and competence of anyone who can sing.
Which Durafle himself picked up on in his own Requiem.
Certainly he did. And in his other mass that he composed, he wrote another mass based on chant melody.
And then you have the great composer Morten Lauritzen, who has come and created a masterpiece that will be sung for the ages.
Is it Osaka Mysterio?
Yeah, and it's I'm sorry, I had a little senior moment there, but Lauritzen has, in my mind, found the right path toward music that is distinguished but yet singable by anybody who wants to, actually try. Oh, Manu Mysterium. That's the piece we were thinking about.
Right.
Have you performed that at Sanctum Grotto?
No, but I know the work.
Oh, you must. I'm going to chastise you on that. This is D.L. Hudson. You're listening to Church and Culture, and I'm talking to Father Edward Perrone, who just told me something that I would have bet $1 million that Father Perrone would have performed Lauritzen's O Monum Mysterium, but I'm sure by the time we talk next time, he will have corrected that. Do you get much congregational singing, much congregational participation? And if so, what do you attribute that to?
We actually do get a good deal of participation from the congregation because they sing the responses of the Mass. They do sing the Kyrie, the Gloria, the Credo.
Whose settings, Father?
A chant.
Oh, it's a chant setting. Okay.
We don't sing very much in the vernacular, I would say, here. We've even cut down our hymn singing to a bare minimum.
So for our listeners, what we're saying is that at Assumption Grotto, his congregation is singing melodies from the Middle Ages or the early Middle Ages, correct?
Correct. And they sing them very well. They sing them. They sing them in the English Mass. They sing them in the Latin Mass. So,
Do you ever have training sessions?
No.
And your choir is just magnificent. We only have a few minutes left in this segment, but when I talk to clergy and sometimes lay people and complain about music, they say, "Well, it costs a lot, and we shouldn't put money into this." That should go elsewhere. What is your argument about the cost of a music program?
Well, there is a cost, of course, and if you're going to do an orchestral mass, you're going to have to raise some money. and the people are going to have to support it. That's very true. But I would say that that is not really the issue. We can have beautiful music without having an orchestra or having only a few instruments. The real problem is a cultural problem, that we don't have musicians well-trained, or we don't want the ones who are well-trained to perform good music, even simple music.
What about your choristers? Are they all volunteer, or do you have?
They're all volunteers.
Wow. You have voices like that come for free. Do you have any problem with a parish having, say, four paid soloists to lead the choir?
I wouldn't. We don't happen to need it.
But that really is the way some parishes that do a good job. They have anchors for each section of their four-part choir.
Sure. I will have to say that when we have an orchestral mass, generally speaking, I will have the solo parts given to those from the outside. I will hire those singers.
At a
Not
time,
that we don't have competent singers to sing them, but I just reserve those for other solos that we have in church for our own choristers.
Yes, I actually for 2 years sang in the Schola Cantorum of an assistant conductor to Robert Shaw in Atlanta.
Oh, wonderful.
And the only way I was able to sing, and we sang both monophony and polyphony, and we sang a lot of Palestrina and a lot of Vittoria, was to stand next to the strongest singer in the choir and just kind of sing along with him.
All right.
And that got me through. And I would not have been able to sing if I hadn't had that anchor guy standing next to me. Yeah. Father Perrone, we've only got a few seconds left. Invite people to your church when they pass through Detroit before we head to the next section.
All right. We are right in the heart of Detroit. We're on the east side. We have a Latin Mass at 9:30, which is usually the choral Mass. And if congregational singing is your desire, we sing at all the other Masses as well, and we sing the Latin chant, even for the vernacular Mass.
Father Perrone, it's a delight to talk to you. We're going to come back and talk to you a little more on the other side of this break. This is Deal Hudson. You're listening to Church and Culture.
Hi, I'm Vanessa Dunha-Garmo, co-publisher and editor-in-chief of the Chaldean News. It's a news magazine for the Chaldean community, about the Chaldean community, and for anyone who wants to engage the Chaldean community. As Christians from Iraq, Chaldeans are proud supporters of Ave Maria Catholic Radio. We invest many hours into this monthly news magazine to keep you invested in the community. You can subscribe or advertise today. Contact us at www.chaldeannews.com. Find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter.
Faith, family, and the culture of life. It's Family Man with Catholic therapist Dr. Gregory Popchak.
Christians know that it's important to be generous in helping others in their times of need. But is there ever a time when helping someone is actually hurting them? Early in my career working with clients, I'd spend the week between appointments worrying a great deal about a client's progress, only to discover in the next session that they often hadn't even thought about my recommendations since our last meeting. In many instances, I found that I was spending more emotional energy on my clients' problems than they were, and that's never a good thing. When you're placed in a position to be of service to others, keep this rule of thumb in mind. Always be prepared to work hard to help another person, but never work harder on solving their problems than they are. To do less than this is to offend generosity, but to do more is to offend the other person's free will, not to mention your own dignity. By keeping this rule of thumb in mind, you can be sure that the help you are offering another person is actually helpful. I'm Dr. Gregory Popchak, but you can call me Family Man.
You've been listening to Family Man with Catholic therapist Dr. Gregory Popchak. To discover more resources for living an abundant life, including books, CDs, and Catholic counseling services, visit us online at exceptionalmarriages.com.
Welcome back to Church and Culture. This is D.L. Hudson. I'm talking to Father Edward Perrone, pastor since 1994 of Assumption Grotto Church in downtown Detroit. He has a magnificent music program, a musical liturgy. He's a performer himself and a composer. Now, Father Perrone, I'm going to put you on the spot and flatter you a little bit. I read a letter that you wrote to your choir members on the Vigil of the Immaculate Conception, I think it's just prior to two performances of your Mass entitled Fountain of Beauty. And I'm going to read a paragraph from that letter. And if you don't have any objection, I'll read it now.
All right.
Now, this is to the chorus. Let me say first that composing an orchestral Mass is a daunting project in view of the illustrious composers who have written in this form. I decided to give it a hand for two reasons, from the encouragement given by some people and by my desire to give something to honor the Mother of God, like the offering made by the juggler before the image of Notre Dame. It's my belief that the Virgin Mary is the most beautiful of all God's creatures in view of the fact that God chose her for the incarnation of his Son. All created beauty, in my view, must then be a participation in her unparalleled beauty, which is reflected in the many great works of art which her beauty has inspired. I wanted, therefore, to make my own contribution, however small, to this vast cultural treasure. For this reason, I dedicated it to her under the title Fountain of Beauty. Now, that to me, that was a very moving thing to say to your choristers, because it really does sum up all we've been talking about in terms of the way in which the beauty of music should be right at the heart of our Catholic culture and our Catholic worship. And why did you, I mean, you had not composed for a long time.
That's correct.
And so did you just get caught up in thoughts about the Mother of God that led you to want to compose a Mass?
Certainly that is true. We had created a number of musicals here in the parish, and I composed the music for them. And I hadn't written music for a long time. And then people approached me and they said, well, if you're writing musicals, why don't you write something for the church? And it never occurred to me to do that, believe it or not. And when I thought that I would do this, my own devotion to Mary and the fact that our church is dedicated to her led me to compose this Mass in her honor. And as you mentioned, the Font of Beauty, Fons Pulchritudinis. And I wonder where you got that letter, by the way. But
well, it's on the internet.
Oh, it is. Okay.
I didn't steal it. Now, we have a recording, your recording of your Mass. I assume this is from the live performance.
Yes, it's a live performance.
The Agnus Dei, and tell us a little bit about it before we play it.
In the Agnus Dei, or in the Mass in general, I've tried to incorporate all the my experience as a priest. In the liturgy, my experience as a pastor, as a conductor, and certainly my training as a composer, to give this honor to God through Our Lady, and I wanted to give that musical expression. And if I succeeded at all in that, then I the work is a success.
Now, has it only been performed the two times in January of 2012?
We performed it once also. At the close of a called the Holiness Conference here at a Pontifical Mass, our first Pontifical Mass since the Vatican Council, and it was very well received.
Did you do this for Benedict?
No. The Pontifical Mass here was done by Bishop Sample from at that time. He was in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan.
And did you use your own chorus and orchestra?
Yes.
Did you take them all up there?
Yes.
Okay. Well, would you describe yourself as a post-romantic composer? Would that
I
be
suppose
fair?
That would be the designation today, yes.
Well, I know that you know that I favor that. And
sure.
So let's listen to, now, is this Agnus Dei just for the chorus, or are there soloists?
There are soloists also.
Okay, let's play that Agnus Dei from the Mass called Fountain of Beauty, composed by Father Edouard Perron. beautiful. We just listened to Father Edward Perrone's Fountain of Beauty Mass, composed in honor of Mary, Mother of God, in 2011 and performed several times. Father, I always like to hear new music, and of course I immediately begin to listen for other composers. And do you know that you have a couple of chords of Frederick Delius at the beginning of that? You really do? No kidding.
I didn't know that in particular, no.
Yeah, well, you do. But also there's I hear a French-inspired but American sound. Is that fair?
I think that's quite accurate, actually. I think the American sound is there, and certainly my involvement in music of Paul Paré has certainly influenced my style.
I was a little surprised by the tempo you chose for your Agnus Dei, which is a kind of a quicker tempo than most composers use on. Why did you do that?
Actually, I think that derives from this French ideal of expressing in the Agnus Dei not the so much the somberness of the Lamb of God slain, but His presence in the on the altar. You'll find this in the Fore Requiem, for example, in that lovely Agnus Dei mm-hmm. there. You'll find it in Paré's Mass in his Agnus Dei. And I wanted to continue that expression, not concentrating so much on the sorrowful dimension, the passion, as it were, the passion motif introduced into the Agnus Dei, but rather the joy of Christ being among us.
You know, and one thing I'm jealous of for you being a composer and having the tools to do that is that as you sit down to write, you have to think long and hard about what the liturgy means, what these words mean.
Sure.
You know, why is the Mass constructed in the way it is? And that's got to be quite a journey to take.
Well, of course, being a priest is a great advantage. Those words are said every day. They're part of my life. I meditate on them. I do spend some time meditating on the liturgy, not only on the scriptures and ponder the meaning, as we are told to do when we're ordained. You know, the bishop tells us to meditate upon what you're doing, and so I try to follow that and to think carefully about what I'm doing at the altar, facing God, representing the people, and perhaps that comes through somewhat in my music. Mm-hmm.
Father Perrone, do you have any future plans to compose some more?
No, I'm only an occasional composer, meaning that you know I will respond to a request or a need, but I don't sit and compose all day. No, don't do it.
Well, you better be careful if that gets out. Now that is your private recording. That has not been issued publicly as
That's
a recording
correct.
At all. Okay. Let's go back to something that we were discussing at the very beginning of our show, and that is the issue of the impact of the liturgy on the worshiper, you know, and the way music assists in that. But there's also the issue of the celebration itself done by the priest, and the word performance comes to my mind. Is it bad to think of it as a performance?
I would say not at all. However, As has been pointed out by someone else, God is the audience, and so we.
Well, talk to me about that.
Well, we are all doing a divine thing. We are. It is Christ's worship of His Father, the priest representing the Lord Himself, the congregation joined with Him as the church body, the membership, Christ the head, and we are all in gesture, in song, and in word. Certainly, we are giving praise to God. So we should look upon it as a performance in the very best sense of the word, that we are doing the liturgy for His glory and for, as it were, His amusement, His delight.
All the more reason that it should be beautiful.
It should be the best we can do.
Are seminarians in Catholic seminaries, do they receive enough training in the art of this performance, in your opinion?
I would say no. I'm sorry to say that, but I think liturgy used to be reduced to the study of the rubrics, and that was always the complaint before the Vatican Council, that all priests did and all seminarians did is learn the correct performance of liturgy. I don't see that it was all bad. It certainly created uniformity and at least exterior semblance of reverence. But today, that is much lacking, that art of the celebration. And so the concentration now in the liturgy would be on liturgical studies more than on the actual reverent participation of the liturgy.
Do clergy ever think about this? When we go to Mass, that is, we lay people, we're looking at the altar the entire time. That means we're looking at the celebrant the entire time. We're looking at his face. We're looking at his gestures. We're looking at his eyes. We're listening to his voice. In other words, we're watching him perform.
Yes.
And again, my experience is sometimes you get the sense of the celebrant going through the motions. Other times you get the sense of the celebrant really connected to both what he's doing and to he's sending out a kind of spirit out into the entire church. You can just feel it. Is there any way to teach that?
I think not. I think it's going to have to come from the depths of the priest's soul. However, let me say this, now that you brought up the subject, that I think the having the priest face the people for the liturgy was a grand mistake. Pope Benedict himself has said this, and so I'm not ashamed to repeat what he said, that we should return to the practice of facing the east. Of course, this brings up another objection about the priest back to the people, which I can speak about as well. But the point is that the priest, we should all be performing for the Lord, and when the priest faces the people, he's put in the position of a talk show host or something of the sort. And he needs to look at the people, even in the most intimate moment that he has at the Mass in taking Holy Communion. Mm-hmm. And I object to that. I think there should be the priest also needs to be praying to the Lord, and yes, inspiring the people perhaps. But when he's constantly against the people, which is really what it says in Latin, right? You know, that he's facing them. It's not creating this unified direction towards God. But rather, he's, as it were, at odds with them. And as Pope Benedict says, you know, the best interpretation he gives to it is that it forms a closed circle. And so the worship doesn't really go heavenbound, it remains earthbound.
I'm talking with Father Edward Perrone from Assumption Grotto Church in Detroit. I'm Deal Hudson, and this is Church and Culture. Father, is that why I sometimes see priests kind of hiding behind the altar when they take communion themselves?
It could be.
I mean, they kind of bend down so it's, you know, yes, barely visible. But let's talk about this turning your back. Now, I became a Catholic in 1984, and I'm well aware of the tradition of the priest turning your back. In fact, I once had a lengthy conversation with the late Cardinal Avery Dulles at Fordham. We were at Fordham together about, you know, why Catholics didn't sing very much in Mass. And he talked to me about this, you know, older tradition of the liturgy where you would come in and it would all be done on the altar by the priest for you. And he described when he was a boy how people would wander around the cathedral doing this and that, going to this and that holy statue. And so, is there a flip side about the turning around that needs to be discussed as well?
Well, I think certainly there is. And, you know, that there was a long... By the way, Cardinal Dulles may have changed his mind later in life. I don't know.
Oh, no, he changed his mind about a lot of things.
Right. So he
did.
He may not have held to that opinion. But the whole idea of facing the East is to orient the liturgy towards God. And our Lord came from the East. He is said to come back to this earth from the East. And so the liturgy has this eschatological dimension that we are longing for the coming of the Lord. We are facing East, really, as is done in other religious bodies. And what it does is that it brings everyone into this unison posture in directing the prayer to God.
Don't some of the Orthodox churches still do this?
Absolutely, even behind an iconostasis.
And do you think that this, the facing of the East of the liturgy, would add a sense of beauty to the liturgy?
Absolutely so.
Why?
Because first of all, I think the whole arrangement of the sanctuary, the altar, the vestments on the back of the priest, the altar servers facing also in one direction, would elevate people's thoughts and hearts towards the Lord.
Very interesting, and I can kind of see that in my mind's eye. It's kind of like staging.
Sure.
We would call it.
Sure.
It's a better form of staging.
Okay.
And it has more sense of theater, isn't that correct?
It does, and in a very natural kind of way, whereas when the priest faces the people, now he's put in the position of being a performer. He has to look good, speak well, of course. His gestures have to be for the picture. In the other scene of the Mass being oriented, it's the priest is no longer important as a individual personality. Rather, he's representing Christ, and so it's the faceless priest that is there leading us into this worship of the Father.
Fascinating. This may be one direction that Catholics could go in addressing the issue of renewing the Church. Do you think that there would be any chance of there being an official decision that facing the East is something that's legitimately done?
Well, we do it here for all our Masses, even the English Mass.
So it is not something that is disallowed?
Absolutely not. It was never forbidden, in fact. And in fact, the Mass facing the people was never officially given as a directive in the Holy See. It's just a custom that developed and now is just taken for granted.
Part of the pastoral outcome of Vatican II.
Sure.
Well, let's really nail that down. So in other words, there was never a directive per se regarding the celebration of the liturgy said the celebrant must face the people, correct?
That's correct. It was actually based on a mistake, and an historical mistake, that they believed in the ancient Roman basilicas that the bishop faced the people. They know that now that is not correct.
So, what you're saying has huge consequences, Father Perone. That's why I don't want to leave it for a second.
Sure.
Are many of clergy and bishops aware that the facing of the congregation is basically not been directed by the Holy See?
I don't know if they're aware of that. If anyone has read Cardinal Ratzinger's book, The Spirit of the Liturgy, he will understand that, as well as some other writings of his, where he's gone at great length to explain the reason for this. He even advocates it at a, if I can call it, a low altar, where the priest would mm-hmm. would be on the people's side of the altar, facing the cross. And so he's written extensively about it.
Do your parishioners, I assume your parishioners, love this form that connects with the entire history of the Church?
I would think that they do. They've never objected to the fact that we no longer use the low altar. In fact, I would say in my priesthood here, I've been at the parish, this year it'll be 20 years.
That's right.
I've hardly ever used the low altar.
Hmm. Well, just, again, I mean, what I'm picking up on, Father Perone, is that in this effort post-Vatican II to get closer to the people by, adapting pop culture styles and pop culture forms of music, actually has lessened the impact of the Mass upon Catholics.
But isn't it ironic that the very thing, the reason, the alleged reason for introducing these changes for greater intelligibility of the liturgy, greater participation of the people, has left people outside the Church has taken people out, and eminent people, as you know, perhaps in the after the new missal was proposed by Pope Paul VI, a number of Catholic intellectuals and artists and politicians, I believe, as well, wrote to Pope Paul VI, asking him to retain the old Mass. And of course, it was refused, and Pope Paul VI just lamented the fact that because of exigencies of the day, that Latin would have to go and so many of these other things. And then we were in the liturgical renewal that we've all known.
Father Perrone, are you aware of many other parishes or cathedrals where the Mass is performed day in and day out toward the east?
I'm aware of some of them. I think it was a growing phenomenon under Pope Benedict. The younger priests seem fascinated with it, as drawn as they are to the celebration of the old Mass, the so-called Tridentine Mass. I think it was a growing thing. I don't know where we are now with that, in that momentum, if it's coming to a halt or not. But I was aware of an increased interest among the younger priests, especially.
D.L. Hudson, we're on Church and Culture and talking to Father Edward Provone from Assumption Grotto in Detroit. Father, why don't Catholics in general recognize beauty as one of the ways to God? They see truth and goodness, but why don't they see beauty as a way to God?
This is a good question. I don't know that it's a universal problem, or it's a more of an American problem. And I say that because, you know, we did not come from a rich native called high culture in this country. We are immigrant peoples, basically. The culture that was brought over here was from Europe. When the churches changed the liturgy, so much of that was discarded as if it were a relic of a past age and a foreign culture. And so what did we have left? What is American? We have, you know, skyscrapers and concrete and junk food and all the rest and the pop music. But what do we have of great culture? And of course, I know we do have some. I'm only speaking in the broadest terms. So I think that the American experience of our people generally, our cultural level has not been terribly high. We don't have the great tradition that we had either in Western Europe or in the Eastern expression in a different way. We haven't brought that to this country. At least the roots apparently were not deep enough, so that when the liturgy was updated and renovated, that we were able to retain or build upon that past. I think the roots were just not sufficiently deep.
Well, Father Perrone, I think many people, including myself, appreciate the fact that you've sort of taken that on in your own church, Assumption Grotto, in Detroit. And I want to thank you very much for being a guest on Church and Culture. And I hope you'll come back again sometime, will you?
Sure. Thank you for the opportunity.
You're listening to Church and Culture. Coming up next is Pastor John Hagee, the founder of the Cornerstone Church in San Antonio, Texas.
As Christians, we are taught that what comes out of the mouth proceeds from the heart. And in Ephesians, it reads, "No bad word should come from your mouth, but only what is good and edifying, that it may give grace to those who hear." If you want to have a clean mouth without having to use soap, start by cleansing the heart. Think back to those various points in life when the anger that festered inside eventually percolated up and right out of your mouth with words of hate for people who have hurt you, offended you, lied to you, used you, abused you, stole from you, or perhaps altered your life forever. When we hold on to the past, we cloud the love of Jesus Christ, and what emerges is the pain inflicted on us from mankind. If you find yourself cursing, spewing hateful words about others, or often negative about life, then close your mouth and open your heart. Fill it with the love of our Lord and let His words emerge from your mouth. This has been a Christ-centered communication message. I'm Vanessa Denha-Garmo, the communication evangelist.
Are you thinking of buying or selling a home? Prices are going up, inventory is low, and interest rates are lower than they've been in 60 years. You need someone that knows what they're doing. That someone is Marvelous Mary Novak of RE/MAX Platinum. Mary is a full-time licensed realtor. If you have a house to sell or want to find a home to purchase, you need Marvelous Mary, who has more than 20 years sales and marketing experience that she'll be pleased to put to work for you. She's an expert at professionally bringing home buyers and home sellers together. So call Marvelous Mary at 248-767-7121 to schedule your free, no-obligation real estate consultation. That's 248-767-7121. You can search any home on the market for free at MarvelousMary.com. Mary is a supporter and listener of Catholic Radio. So call Marvelous Mary today at 248-767-7121 and let her prove to you why her clients call her Marvelous Mary.
The following is a message brought to you by the Catholic Biblical School of Michigan.
In his gospel, John treats faith as a verb, an action that must be taken. And Jesus continuously invites people into this action. He suggests to the Samaritan woman, "Give me a drink." And when she responds, her life is forever changed. He invites some of John's disciples to come and see where he lives. They do and invite others, and thus is formed the core of Jesus' mission team. He asks a friend, "Why are you weeping?" And a sick man, "Do you want to be healed?" These questions invite an interior vulnerability, a deeper type of faith-filled response. And Jesus always extends such invitations to us. Let us pray that we may respond in faith, letting Him lead us into deeper relationship with Him and an abundant life in His love. This message is brought to you by the Catholic Biblical School of Michigan.
Just what is John Paul II's new evangelism? What is the kerygma? Are they the reason for the drop in participation at Mass?
What is underway is nothing less than a demographic collapse in the Catholic Church. From the year 2000 to 2009, there was a 3% drop in the Catholic population, but a 16% drop in Mass attendance, five times as large as the drop in the Catholic population. Even more worrisome, a 33% drop in baptisms. There's not a new generation coming along formed in the faith.
This is Henry Root, your host for Putting on the Mind of Christ. Sacred Heart Major Seminary's Dr. Mary Healy addressed the directors of religious education from all over Michigan and beyond.